Hello, and welcome to the Shifting Culture Podcast, in which we have conversations about the culture we create and the impact we can make. We long to see the body of Christ look like Jesus. I'm your host, Joshua Johnson. Go to shiftingculturepodcast.com to interact and donate. And don't forget to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast app to be notified when new episodes come out each Tuesday. And while you're at it, leave a rating and review. It's pretty easy to hit that five-star button, and it helps attract new listeners. Previous guests on the show have included Michael Carrion, Brian Zond, and David Fitch. You can go back, listen to those episodes, and more. But today's guest is Christopher Watkin. Chris holds a PhD in modern French philosophy from Cambridge University. After lecturing at Cambridge, he moved to Australia and now teaches at Monash University in Melbourne, where he lives with his wife Allison and their two children. He is the author of 10 books, including his latest, Biblical Critical Theory, How the Bible Story Makes Sense of Modern Life and Culture. We have a great conversation around analyzing culture, language, and thought, how the Bible story helps us view and critique culture and the world we live in, and we get practical examples of how to do it. It's a fascinating conversation, so sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Christopher Watkin. Well, Chris, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Joshua. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you and really dive into your latest book, Biblical Critical Theory, and what that looks like. But, you know, I'd love to, as looking at your vast work, it seems eclectic, but there is a thread. What is a thread to your work like that holds things together and says, this is what I'm passionate about?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I've had to think about this quite a lot over the years. I think what ties everything together, and it wasn't conscious at the time, but looking back, I think it works, is that in everything I've written, I'm trying to understand how different people see the world, make sense of the world.
Yeah.
Especially people who are not like I am, who think differently and live differently to me. To try and work out why people arrive at the positions they arrive at, why they're excited by what they're excited by, and what different positions feel like and look like from the inside, I suppose.
Mm. I think that's a crucial stance, I think, for us as humans to try and interact and to see where we're coming from and what we're doing. And I think if we're open and curious like that and asking questions and trying to understand people of other cultures and other faiths and in different perspectives, I think it'll actually go a long way as as humans to try to interact that way. And oftentimes we don't try to see things from different perspectives. One of the things is, as you entered into French and learning French and then European philosophy and modern thought and all of this, what was something that was a surprising thing of learning another language and started to think in a different language in French? Did it change your perspective and the way that you started to think about things?
I think the short answer is yes. Let me try and dig around in my mind for an example of that. There's this wonderful term, slightly clumsy but really helpful in language learning, called lingua cultures. And it's the idea that every language isn't just sort of a neutral set of words for describing the world, but it brings its own culture with it and reflects its own culture. And you can't learn a language without inhabiting a culture if you're going to learn it properly.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. And I think the way that French people and the French language understands the world is, I guess, from an English speaker's point of view, you could say it's uncanny in the sense that there's so much overlap with an Anglophone outlook, but at significant moments, it's just a little bit, from an English point of view, off kilter or strange, that you never feel completely at home as an English speaker in it. And I just find that wonderful and fascinating. The French have this idea about their own language traditionally that it's Cartesian, that it's clear and distinct ideas. And I remember it being explained to me in terms of the difference between Shakespeare and the French playwright Racine. So, you know, Shakespeare has this amazing vocabulary. I don't know how many words he has, but it's absolutely huge. And Racine is very clipped and precise. He's got a very few words, but he makes them really, really count. And there's a difference there in the way that poetry and culture see themselves inhabiting the world. Mm. You know, that you could write a whole dissertation on if you wanted to dig into that. And look, if that's true for English and French, and, you know, and within English and French, you've got dialects, and there's, you know, Canadian English, US English, lots of US Englishes, lots of UK Englishes. You know, so you can do this within languages as well. And if that's true for, you know, cultures that stress so much of their heritage, then how much more is that the case for cultures that are more distant in terms of the ideas and the heritage that they share?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, my wife grew up in on the eastern side of the U.S., more in the south, southern culture. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle area. And so there are still times, oftentimes, my wife says something and I'm like, what is that? It comes from a totally different background and culture. And I'm trying to interact in those spaces, but then it opens me up and says, you know, it makes me a little bit more curious about where she came from, who she is, how she interacts in the world. Even though I know her deeply, it actually opens up a little curiosity for me. And so how do we enter into these relationships? I could say my wife and I are a cross-cultural relationship, even though we're both, you know, white Americans that love Jesus and we have a lot of similarities, but I think every relationship is a little bit cross-cultural. So how do we enter into those to open ourselves up into more curiosity?
I suppose a first step, a crucial, necessary first step, is to realize that your way of looking at the world, my way of looking at the world, isn't simply common sense. It isn't simply the place where everybody starts and then some people add some weird stuff onto my sort of common sense view. And I think that's one thing that learning a language does for you. It allows you to see your own language and culture from the outside as someone looking in on it and say, oh, yeah, that is actually really quite odd about my own culture. I'd never really noticed that before because it was the only way that I'd ever encountered the world. But now that I've got two possibilities, you know, I can look at the world through the lens of the English with which I grew up, or I can, you know, immerse myself in French culture, I begin to see idiosyncrasies and strangenesses and sometimes even contradictions in my own way of looking at the world. And that, I think, is such a healthy realization to come to. Not that you throw the baby out with the bathwater. You think, oh, you know, it's all relative. Nobody has any sort of meaningful angle on the world. But you realize, you know what? I've got a position too. Mm-hmm. And my position isn't neutral in the sense of everybody starts where I start and then some people become weird and some people just stay like me, you know, normal and the measure for everybody else. I think that's the first step, just to realize that none of us are the referee or the umpire on the pitch. We're all players, you know, we've all got a dog in the fight. And no one person's language or culture is necessarily the measure against which all others should be judged.
Mm. You know what? I find this your book really fascinating, and I'd love to get into, you know, just as a background. My dad wrote a book on biblical worldview integration, and so he wanted to try and figure out how do I actually view the world through the lens of the Bible. And then integrate that into curriculum and how we teach, and so that people can see that perspective. And so that's been, you know, 25 years ago, and I've been really walking into this and wrestling in it and trying to figure out, you know, the best way to go about actually looking at things through a a different lens and a certain type of lens. And I love how you walk through the story of the Bible, and it's story-based, it's narrative-based, and that we could actually start to use it as a lens to view our modern culture in it. Can you just take us a little bit through this book and what you're trying to accomplish through it, and what is your framework as you started to enter into it?
Yeah, thank you. The book is really born out of a sense of frustration, I suppose it was, that I had as an undergraduate. So I was an undergraduate at a big secular university in an arts faculty, studying all sorts of philosophical and theoretical approaches week after week, churning essays out about them, you know, Marx, Freud, Nietzsche, Foucault, Derrida, Kristeva, et cetera, et cetera. And I was also attending a Bible-believing church where I was challenged to take the Bible seriously and apply it to the whole of life. And there was really no space in my life at that time where those two worlds could talk to each other, where the Bible could sit around the table with these theoretical approaches and make the case for its own view of reality. You know, in my university units, there was no way that the Bible would be allowed in. And it wasn't particularly discussed at my church. And so I guess I wanted to get that conversation going. I wanted the Bible to have a voice in this theoretical debate. And the two things that helped me to see how that might happen were my first Bible overview that I did at a Christian summer camp I went on. I was a junior leader, and we had as well as sort of helping with the washing up and things like that, we had a teaching program, and one of the streams was a Bible overview. It was just mind-blowing. It was a real penny drop moment to see that the Bible isn't just a collection of stories from God with meanings, but it is, from the first page to the last, one complex, multi-layered, unfolding story. Yeah. And not just a story within reality, but a story of reality, you know, inside which you can live, and that a story that makes sense of the world, a true story that makes sense. And the second thing that happened was that I read Augustine's City of God one summer on holiday with my parents. I think it probably rained all week. I can't remember. But anyway, we had a lot of time for reading. So I plowed through the City of God. Look, most of it, if I'm being honest, went over my head. But the bit that I did understand was that Augustine was using this Bible overview framework to critique late Roman culture, like all of it. You know, it's games, it's religion, it's civic life, it's superstition, it's military, everything. And he could do it all through this Bible overview framework. And I think I realized from that point on, this is the pattern to use. Like, Augustine has set the bar for the way to do cultural criticism here. It is a narrative framework that makes sense of it for us. And then, you know, year after year, just chipping away, reading different things, putting little pieces of the jigsaw together. Over time, I sort of built up this framework for trying to understand modern and contemporary Western culture in a way analogous to the way in which Augustine tries to grapple with late Roman culture.
Yeah, I love that. Can you give us an example? So if you're actually then grappling with modern culture and trying to look at it through this lens, can you give us an example of something within modern culture that we could start to look at it and to walk through how we could apply this just to view the culture?
I think there's a great pathos, a great sadness, almost a tragedy, I suppose, in the way that modern culture thinks about human beings. And I think a way to get a handle on it is through the idea of the image of God in Genesis chapter 1. And the wonderful thing about the image of God motif is that it does two things really, really well. First of all, it it exalts and dignifies human beings. So, you know, of everything in the whole created order, only human beings and every human being is in the image of God. So, you know, not the Milky Way that you can look up to at night, not a beautiful school of whales, not an ocean, not a sunset, not the greatest piece of music ever written. None of those are in the image of God, only human beings. And therefore, there's an incredible dignity and specialness to being human in this world. But the image of God also humbles human beings, because precisely we're not God, we're the image of God, you know. So lest we should think too much of ourselves, the image of God reminds us, you know, you're not the top dog in reality. God is, and you are in his image. And there's no sense in the image of God doctrine that those two things are in conflict with each other.
Yeah,
it's not that we're half dignified and half humbled. No, there's a beautiful harmony between them. But then you look at what modernity does with anthropology, and you find that it splits these two tendencies and tends to emphasize either one of them or the other, makes half of that beautiful biblical harmony into the whole truth. And so on one hand, you've got writers like Thomas Hobbes at the dawn of modernity in his foundational book of political thought, Leviathan, saying in the first chapter that human beings are essentially machines. We're just cogs and springs and strings and wheels. That's really all there is to us. So let's not fool ourselves. Yeah, and there are a whole sort of lorry load of writers in modernity that you could gather together to say that either we're fundamentally machines, or we're fundamentally just like the other animals. There's nothing different to us. Mm. And that's taking this idea of humbling. You know, human beings are in Genesis 1 made on the same day as the other animals. There's some truth somewhere in that idea, but it's been distorted and twisted and blown out of all proportion and dismembered from its twin truth of human dignity.
Mm.
And so modernity does that on one side. And on the other side, it's got this huge sort of bloated, hyper-inflated idea of human beings that basically presents us as gods.
Yeah.
And John Milbank is really good on this in the early chapters of Theology and Social Theory. He shows how the idea of the voluntarist God in theological history, this idea of a God whose will is unchallengeable, and voluntarism can get really extreme about this. So, for example, you know, if God wants 2 and 2 to make 11, he can.
Yeah.
Because the laws of logic are no impediment. Like that sort of will, that level of untrammeled will. He shows how modernity takes that idea from God and actually uses that as a pattern for human will and tries to think of human beings as beings who can remake reality in our own image, whose wills conquer everything, who can decide for ourselves what is good and evil in the same way that God does, and for that to be valid, who can decide our reality, who can decide our identity, and on and on and on. And how that is a modern anthropology. And so in modernity, you've got these two incompatible, extreme ideas of what a human being is. And the modern world sort of says to us, you're a machine. Oh, and by the way, you're also a god. Now go and live your life.
Yeah.
And that is psychologically incredibly burdensome. You can begin to understand why it is so hard psychologically to live in modernity and to make sense of ourselves in modernity. If the message we're given is, you know, you're no different to the computer sitting in front of you fundamentally in the way that you were.
Yeah.
You're just more complex than that. Oh, and also you're a voluntary Scot. And the idea that can be an easy position to inhabit is just ridiculous. That is incredibly hard, incredibly stressful to live in. And so the way that you read that from a biblical point of view, or the word that I use in the book, the way that you diagonalize that opposition is to say there's a tiny bit of distorted and twisted truth in both of those positions, but the problem is that they've cut it off from the rest of the biblical truth.
Yeah.
The beautiful thing about the Bible is that all the truths exist in an ecosystem with each other, in sort of a perfect harmony, perfect sort of way of coexisting, if you like. And what modernity does, again and again, is it takes little scraps of biblical truth, blows them up to be the whole truth, twists them, cuts them off from all the other biblical truths, and expects that to work in terms of a valid way of living in the world. And so I think we're calling people back to a wonderful, wholesome, healthy, exciting biblical harmony, away from the shards and splinters of the modern way of looking at things.
And that takes a lot of wisdom and discernment as we're walking through life and starting to look at the world as we're seeing that, oh, there's some truth to what they're saying, and there's some truth to this viewpoint, but they don't have the complete truth. They don't have the other side. And it seems like there's a lot of black and white of we're blowing it up to this is the only way, the only truth, where there is some nuance to it. How do we start to interact with the world through this nuanced way, this gray, where we're trying to make sense of the world and we want some wisdom of God to do that?
It's a wonderful question. I think it's a really deep question. I think the first thing to recognize is that it's not that each of the modern positions has half of the truth, and what you need to do is simply split the difference between them. So you don't start with the two anthropologies of we're just machines and we're gods and say, well, let's say then that we're half machines and half gods, because that's not a biblical view.
Yeah.
It's the idea of the image of God is not a half and half thing. So it's not about splitting the difference. I think the best pattern for the best answer to the question that you've asked is in 1 Corinthians 1, in the way that Paul engages with some dominant values of his day. So, you know, he looks out in the world around him and he sees that Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks seek wisdom. You know, there are two things that these two different communities really covet and value and pride in possessing. And he does two things with those values. And I think we're very good at doing either one or the other, but it's rare that we'll do both. The first thing that he does is he draws a radical antithesis between those cultural values and the gospel. You know, he says, for example, Greeks, you seek wisdom, but the word of the cross is foolishness. In other words, this, you can't just keep on going seeking wisdom in the way that you are, in a straight line, continue on, and arrive at the cross. The cross is not wise in the way that you think wisdom ought to be understood. There's a radical break, there's a discontinuity between your value and the gospel. And if that was all that he did, you know, you'd think that he was sort of pushing what H. Richard Niebuhr would call a Christ against culture paradigm. Whatever the culture is saying, the gospel is the opposite. And that's what some Christian cultural commentators do today. They always simply put the gospel in radical opposition to whatever's going on in the culture. Culture says A, gospel says Z.
Z works here.
That, okay, thank you. International podcast.
Yeah.
But he doesn't. He goes on a couple of verses later to say that the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom. So at that point, what's he doing? He's putting them, if you like, on a scale of wisdom. So he's putting the wisdom that the Greeks are looking for and the foolishness of God on this wisdom scale. And he's saying the foolishness of God is higher up that wisdom scale. It's more wise than the Greek wisdom. And so at that point, he's issuing, if you like, a challenge to the Greeks. He says, if you're really serious about searching for wisdom, are you willing to look for it in the place where you would least think it to be found? In other words, the foolishness of a condemned criminal in your eyes, dying a painful death and a shameful death on a cross. And his challenge is, if you are willing to look for wisdom there, you will find a depth and a fullness and a richness of wisdom that will far exceed anything you currently think of under that term of wisdom. So he's saying that this foolishness of God is actually the fulfillment of your quest. If you really want wisdom, you're only going to find the fullness of it in the foolishness of God. And the brilliance of Paul's approach in 1 Corinthians 1 is he does both of those things. So the idea that the foolishness of God is the fulfillment of human wisdom, the quest for human wisdom, doesn't water down the idea that there's an antithesis. Yeah. You've still got to completely break apart your idea of what wisdom is and rebuild it differently in order to arrive at God's foolishness. You can't just bolt it on to a Greek idea of wisdom. It doesn't fit.
Yeah.
So the antithesis is insurmountable. You've got to hammer the antithesis 100%, if you like. But you've also got to be all out on fulfillment. You can't simply say the gospel is incompatible with your idea of wisdom. If you want to be biblical about it, if you want to follow this 1 Corinthians 1 pattern, you've also got to say, and the gospel is the ultimate fulfillment of everything you long for when you talk about wisdom. And it's that combination, I think, that's the beautiful biblical harmony that I think Christian cultural criticism is at its best when it's doing both of those.
Yeah.
And rather than simply saying, no, the gospel is always incompatible with culture, or simply always saying, everything that you think you want, dear world, find it in Christ, without breaking it down and rebuilding it. And I think our cultural criticism tends sometimes to one or either of those two poles, but Paul shows how you can hold them together.
I love that. And thinking through, you know, a lot of my work, one of the things that I do is I lead a missions agency that goes and shares Jesus around the world. And so I'm training missionaries a lot of times to really assess culture, to look at culture, to dive deep, to be very thoughtful, and to know what's going to be good news for the culture there. What are the things that they're longing for, and how does Jesus fulfill that? So how then do we go into a culture and start to critically look at culture and then be curious of culture so that we can start to learn about those things where there is some truth that they're longing for, that the gospel has an answer for, and we can actually say, here it is. And so what are some ways that we can start to analyze culture that way?
I think that, again, the Pauline pattern is to, in Acts 17, is to walk around with your eyes open, isn't it? You know, I was having a look around Athens, and you know, this is what I spotted. And he's obviously read his Greek poets as well. So I think you can't do this on the fly. You can't just read a crib sheet, you know, or a one page summary of a particular culture and expect to be able to engage with it in any meaningful way that the people who live in that culture will say, yes, you've understood me. And I think, again, Augustine is a brilliant example here. So he's a consummate insider to late Roman culture. You know, he teaches rhetoric in Carthage and then later on in Rome. And you can tell in the City of God, he really admires Cicero. And it's not just a pretend admiration. He understands the beauty of Ciceronian prose and the way in which Cicero is thinking. And he says so. Not that he agrees, of course, with everything Cicero says, but you can nevertheless see this is really good writing and really profound writing. But crucially, Augustine is also an outsider, partly because of his biography. So, you know, he's born in North Africa. He's not at the heart of the Roman Empire. He's got a pagan father and a wonderful Christian mother, Monica. And so he's sort of outside inside biographically, but the main thing that places him at an odd angle to Roman culture is just that he's so steeped in the Bible, and he sees things through biblical lenses, not through Roman lenses. And it's that wonderful combination of being an insider and an outsider at the same time that allows him to be such an incisive cultural critic, I think. And I guess then that's something that it's good for us to try to aim for in our own cultural critique, to be an insider to the point of view where you can see why, you know, the modern equivalent of Cicero sparkles to Romans, why they think Cicero not only is speaking truthfully, but is speaking brilliantly. You can see why people get excited about the bits of culture they get excited about. And you can explain that in a way that those people who are within that culture will say, yes, you've understood it. Those are the words that I would use to describe it. You get me. But you've also got to have the equally important element of being an outsider.
Yeah.
And being able to look at it with the, you know, with the eyes of not someone who's completely steeped in it, but almost, you know, an anthropologist studying it from the outside, coming to a foreign culture with a notebook and noting all its oddities and its quirky weirdnesses. And I think if we can do that, which I think is what Paul is doing in Athens and what Augustine is doing with late Roman culture, then we'll be in a great position to speak a word to the culture that can be heard, but that's also surprising and different, and it's not just sort of polishing a mirror to reflect the culture back to itself.
Yeah, I think that's a crucial point, to be an insider and an outsider, to be able to go in to know the culture well. There's a lot of, I mean, I'll go into an American perspective. There's encampments of the church that are just opposed to culture. They don't want to be insiders of culture and be able to speak that language. They want to just stay opposed to the culture and not speak the language to actually win people. And some people are so much insiders that they aren't really that much of an outsider at all and don't see much critically. And so how, as communities of Christ followers, then how can we help look at things critically to engage culture in such a way where culture is saying, yes, that actually makes sense. That actually is hitting what I'm longing for, hitting what I'm looking for. These are the words that I want to use. And not just say, I mean, a lot of times culture thinks that Christians are just against everything. We're known for what we're against, right? And so that's not helpful in a culture, is just to be known of what we're against. How are we doing that as Christ followers? How do we get into that place?
I think two things are necessary, and every Christian community will almost certainly be better at one of these than the other. And so I guess every, I don't know, pastor or missionary leader, and every individual Christian, every family needs to sort of audit themselves to work out which of these needs most work for me or for us. And the first one is just having a really thick, formative Christian community. And this is about being an outsider to the culture.
Yeah.
That we're, as Augustine was, as Paul was, we're so steeped in the rhythms and patterns of a biblical way of looking at the world that we never completely feel at home in the ambient culture, whatever that culture is.
Yeah.
And I think that needs more than a 1-hour church service on a Sunday morning. You know, the world is catechizing us very aggressively and very effectively from the moment we wake up, usually, to the moment we go to sleep, through our smartphones, through advertising, through all the appliances in our house. It's not just ideas. It's not just speaking to us. It's shaping our view of the world through the objects around us and through the rhythms and patterns of our daily life and through the unspoken expectations of us. And it's doing that really, really well.
Yeah.
And so in order to be able to get an angle on that, that's not just accepting all of that unthinkingly, you need a really rich Christian community that's functioning not just on the level of ideas, but of habits and behaviors, that's deeply forming Christians to be able to inhabit this biblical story. Again, you know, from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep. And that's crucial in order to be an effective outsider to the culture.
Yeah.
But the second thing, I guess, is to be able to understand and engage with aspects of culture as an insider character. And I think this will be different for every community. So, you know, I'm a philosopher, and I sort of, I'm paid to go deeply into complex ideas and pull them apart, but that's not everyone's job. Yeah. You know, Paul has this wonderful image of the Church of Christ as a body. And, you know, academics are probably at a toenail somewhere down the bottom. You know, we've got our thing. We're helpful. We do our stuff. But, you know, to say to everybody, you must be a toenail too, just because I am, would be ridiculous. And, yeah. and you know, would be a travesty of that picture of the body. So not everybody needs to take a deep dive into the sort of details of culture. But I think to be aware, you know, whenever we watch a film or walk down a street and see a bunch of adverts, you know, to have a reflexive thought of, you know, just really simply, how does this fit with the biblical story? What is it reflecting of the biblical story, and what's different? And by biblical story there, I think at its simplest, we just mean creation, fall, redemption.
Yeah.
You know, let's just have that as a little framework. And, you know, you can do that in 10, 20 seconds, I think, for aspects of culture. Or you could sit down and have a, you know, a small group, Bible study group discussion. Yeah. Let's take a film. Let's read it through that lens of creation, fall, redemption, which is really all that Augustine's doing over 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
And just try and understand it that in that way. Mm. And that might help you more to become an insider. Mm. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps a lot. You know, one thing that might flesh it out a little bit. Do you have an example of a film that you're familiar with that you could do a little reflection quickly?
A really good question, Joshua. Let me think. Okay. So I will talk about Avengers Endgame,
okay.
Which is, I hope, a film that most people have seen by now. And I hope that by talking about it, I won't be spoiling it for anyone.
All right. Spoilers ahead for Avengers Endgame.
Yeah. If you haven't seen it, shock horror, cartoon film, the good guys win. I hope that's not a scandal to him. And that's probably where you'd start, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the shape of that film, the shape of the you know, Infinity War and Endgame, is that you introduce a seemingly insurmountable problem into the plot. You know, so here's this incredibly powerful guy Thanos who's going to wipe out half the world. You reach a crisis point where it seems that all is lost. You know, I can't remember exactly where that is in the film, but there's one point where it looks as though all their plans to save the universe have been dashed to pieces. It looks as though there's no hope. And then out of the jaws of defeat, surprise, surprise, the superheroes, the Avengers, manage to drag the most wonderful of victories in this amazing final battle. And there is both a sense in which that is uncannily Bible-like and a sense in which it's very not unlike the Bible. And the sense in which it's like the Bible is that shape of a story, introduce a problem, look as though it's all lost, final victory is sort of wrested from the jaws of defeat. Well, that's sin and the cross and the resurrection and then the final judgment, isn't it? And that is the shape that the stories that most resonate, certainly within a Western frame, take. You know, you see film after film after film, book after book after book, and that is the shape of the story. And there's no accident there. That is a gospel shape. But of course, the difference is who does the redeeming.
Yeah.
And so the modern view, again and again and again, in film after film after film, is that we save ourselves. And that is, at least in part, what's happening in Endgame. It's the Avengers themselves who bring victory out of the jaws of defeat, and so you can see that it's following a creation, fall, redemption schema, but it's significantly and fundamentally rewriting that schema. It's parasitic upon a Christian frame, but it's saying that we are our own saviors. Look, I realize that sort of MCU critics, as I'm saying this, will say that there's lots of details of this film that I'm not engaging with. Look, I'm trying to do this in a minute or two. Have mercy on me.
You're doing great.
And I'm sure there's more to say on this, but I think this is a good place to start in terms of the film.
I think that's helpful.
It's parasitic on a Christian framework, which most of modernity is. It's taking Christian ideas, but decontextualizing them, rewriting significant parts of them, and presenting them in a way, you know, here we're circling back to 1 Corinthians 1. In order to sort of bring Endgame back to the Christian story, you'd need to both completely subvert it and completely fulfill it. You'd need to say, this is absolutely not what the gospel is. We do not save ourselves in any means, form, or fashion. And yet, what you're looking for in the terms of a climactic, wonderful, cathartic, fulfilling end to a story where everything turns out well in the end, despite the fact that it looks as though it's impossible, that the deepest, richest, most resonant human fulfillment of that narrative arc is God's story of reality in the Bible.
Yeah.
So it's fulfillment and antithesis again.
Wow. Wow. I think that's so helpful to walk us through what that actually looks like, to start to create, critique things and to look at things through this framework. You know, I'm not in the philosophical thought circles and actually really engaging in that philosophy world. If you've used some of this in thought when people are doing some thinking within philosophy, what does it look like having this standing up to other modern thinkers in the philosophy world?
It looks... I'm trying not to repeat myself and say that it looks like both a subversion and a fulfillment of eternity, because I think your listeners might be getting slightly tired of that constant refrain in all of my answers. I need to acknowledge that this idea of subversive fulfillment comes from a colleague of mine, a brilliant Christian thinker, Dan Strange, who gets it from the missiologist J.H. Bavinck. Bavinck has this idea of subversive fulfillment, which is essentially a way of talking about this 1 Corinthians 1 dynamic. I think you see it happening in thinkers like Oliver O'Donovan, Richard Borkham, John Milbank, Esther Meek. I think she's got a brilliant way of refiguring modern ways of knowing in a biblical frame, in a way that both subverts and fulfills them. So Esther Meek's sort of approach is to understand knowledge in terms of a covenant framework with reality. So the reality, and I hope I get the language right here, and apologies to Esther if I don't, sort of invites itself to be known, invites itself to come into relationship with us. And of course, this idea of covenant is a profoundly biblical idea. You know, covenant theology is a whole branch of theology. And so rethinking a modern way of knowledge, which essentially divides the knower from the known, from Descartes onwards. And in many ways, and there's a passage in Francis Bacon that's very clear about this, but I think it's implicit in a lot of modern knowledge. It's a violent battle between the knower and the known. We have to wrest knowledge out of reality, to wring knowledge out of the world. And Esther really overturns that and says that to know fully is to enter into covenant relationship with. Now, of course, that's eminently true of our relationship with God and with other human beings, but she makes, I think, a persuasive argument to say that is also the way that we know everything in the world. And just by shifting that paradigm of knowing onto a biblical frame, all sorts of consequences cascade out of that for the way that we relate to the natural world, the environment, for example, the way that human relationships are figured within society. And it's not that modernity is simply subverted. It's quest for knowledge is also fulfilled in that covenant paradigm. And so, you know, we're right back at 1 Corinthians 1.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. That actually brings us into this place where we're not just servants to our iPhones, and so we could Google everything and we have knowledge about something, right? I could get facts, but it actually brings us into, you know, what brain scientists talk about is our autobiographical memory, the things that can actually project into the future, is that when we actually know something and we are covenantly known, we actually enter into that story of knowledge, where then we can project ourselves into the future of it, as opposed to facts and figures, which actually we can't project into the future of facts and figures. So it doesn't actually really impact the way that I interact in the world as much. So I think that's crucial as we move forward, and to actually then start to pull out what this knowledge is and how do we know and what is that. I think that's a crucial thing. That's pretty fascinating to me.
Joshua, can I say something controversial and then try and explain why it's not quite so controversial as yeah. I seem at the beginning? Facts are not real. Okay, that's my controversial statement. And at this point, all the prejudices that people might have about me studying postmodern philosophers are going to come flooding in, and they're going to say, I knew it. You know, he doesn't think anything's real. What I mean by that is that there is a reality that can be known, and it is God's reality. But God is not a fact in the way that modernity understands that term, which is a state of affairs about the world, shorn of all personality, shorn of all value, that the world that God is... So there are two ways of looking at the world, and this is John Frame. Either everything that's personal reduces sooner or later to the impersonal, and reality is fundamentally impersonal, which is a modern view of reality. Or the view of reality according to which everything impersonal sooner or later reduces to the personal God, because he is, as Cornelius Van Til would put it, back of everything. And those are two very different universes to live in. And if everything is impersonal, then it might be possible to wrangle with the idea of fact as ultimate. But not, I think, in the world that God has created, because his reality that we can know, you know, so this is not relativism. God has created a world that we can know, but it's not a world of facts that are dislocated from any meaningfulness or any ethical value. You'll see this right back in 1 Corinthians 1. The "it was so" and the "it was good," you know, God saw that it was good, are both part of reality. It's not that God creates some sort of neutral, inhuman, abstract world of facts and then says, right, let's give these facts some meaning. No, the meaningfulness and the goodness of creation is hard baked into it at the same level as the facts. And so when modernity conjures with facts, it's actually dealing with abstraction, abstracted from God, the way that God has made the world. And that's the sense in which facts are unreal. They're at one level of remove from reality. They're pretending that reality is not fundamentally personal, that back of everything isn't a creator God, but our impersonal forces, and that those have absolutely no ethical weight whatsoever. So I hope it's not quite as controversial as it originally
is. It's not quite, well, not to me, at least. Maybe to a few people, but not to me. And I love that you get into that place of the personal and the personal God. I think we need to move in that direction as we're thinking about life, the way that we interact in the world, and the way that we view the world. So as then, hopefully, we're inspiring some people to go and to do a deep dive in your book, because it is a deep dive, and it's there's a lot of great, great things in there. What are some things you want the readers to get out of to really start to apply to their life?
I don't want to prescribe what readers will get out of it. I think there are a lot of different things that people could potentially find in the book, you know, and God's spirit works in different ways in different people. But perhaps just a handful of things that some readers, by God's grace, might find in there are a way of being on the front foot in public debate about the questions that really matter from a Christian point of view. So it often feels, doesn't it, living as a Christian today, is that the only time that Christians ever appear in the news media is to be beaten over the head with a stick about something that we believe or something that we've done. And, you know, sometimes that's right. You know, Christians have behaved abominably. In some Christians have behaved abominably in recent years. And when they do that, it's true, it's right and proper that be called out. So I'm not criticizing that. But I think there's also something that's missed from the public debate when the Christian voice is frozen out on the prejudice that it's got nothing to add, that it's simply a regressive, reactionary, hurtful, damaging voice. Because the Bible does have surprising, constructive, subversively fulfilling perspectives to bring to a lot of the debates that we're struggling with as a whole society today. And if that voice is lost from the conversation, then I think the whole society loses something, not just Christians. And so I hope that the book might help people to find a way of sort of situating ourselves in the world and a vocabulary to use to be, you know, humbly but confidently on the front foot in public and not simply always reacting to attacks on Christianity. I hope it might help some people perhaps who are in the situation that I was as an undergraduate, you know, living in these two different worlds, you know, your studies in the arts faculty with all these theoretical positions, and then, you know, your Bible teaching churches, to find a way to bring the Bible to that table, to that theoretical conversation, and to let the Bible speak into and reconfigure and critique those theoretical positions. And I guess I just hope that the book might encourage Christians who do have a heart for culture to press more deeply into the Bible in order to be better cultural critics. I think sometimes there's an unspoken assumption that the best cultural criticism sort of hovers 30,000 feet above the biblical texts and sort of wrangles with theoretical and philosophical and even theological concepts, but doesn't actually dig into the scriptures. And I think Augustine puts a bomb under that paradigm and says, no, the best cultural criticism, and I think Augustine's City of God is the best cultural criticism that Christians have produced in 2,000 years, presses deeper and deeper and deeper into the Bible.
Yeah.
Both the overall shape of the Bible, creation, fall, redemption, but also individual passages as well. Mm-hmm. And if Christians can get a taste and an excitement for leaning into the Bible as a means to do cultural criticism better, then that would be wonderful.
Yeah, that's great. There's a couple questions I have here at the end. One, if you could go back to your 21-year-old self, what advice would you give?
I think I would say keep mistrusting yourself and trusting God and be patient. So I think at 21, I had very little sense of the things that I now articulate in the book, but I'd listened, I think by that point, to an incredibly helpful talk by Nicholas Walterstorff that's floating around somewhere on the Biola website, I think, where he said, Christian academics, don't try to reinvent your discipline overnight. You're not going to be an Alvin Plantinger in the first year of your PhD. He said, hang in there. There's some questions that you won't be able to answer. That's okay. Give it time. Learn your discipline and learn the Bible and be patient about it. And that's just been incredibly helpful for me over the years. Yeah. So I'd say to my 21-year-old self, watch the Walterstorff video, learn from his wisdom, take your time. You won't be able to do everything tomorrow.
That's good. Anything you've been reading or watching lately you could recommend?
Yes, certainly. How long have we got? there's a brilliant book by Chatrow and Allen that's coming out soon called The Augustine Way. that I had the privilege of reading recently to provide an endorsement. That's just really, really helpful. Showing how Augustine provides a paradigm for contemporary cultural criticism. Just finished a really interesting collection of essays called, now let me get this right. It's based on Kuiper's Stone Lectures, and it's called Something for a Secular Age, Kuiper for a Secular Age, Christianity for a Secular Age, something like that, I'm not sure. But it's a series of reflections on how Kuiper's Stone Lectures can be sort of deployed in the 21st century, which is just really, really helpful. And I'm reading some Van Til at the moment and just coming to him. It's a while since I've read Van Til. And I'm just finding really refreshing the way that he approaches modern culture with a set of really crisp concepts that help to make things visible in the way that modernity operates that you wouldn't necessarily notice if he hadn't come up with these concepts. Principle of continuity, principle of discontinuity, that sort of thing. He's just a very incisive thinker. He's one of those thinkers that you don't have to agree with everything he says in order to get a lot out of his method and his approach, which I'm finding at the moment.
That's great. Where can people connect with you and your work and get your latest book and your other works?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of Christian resources on the site thinkingthroughthebible.com, all one word, and people might find some helpful things there. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Dr. Chris Watkin. And the book, there have been supply chain issues. I think the book is quite hard to get as we're recording this at the moment. The publishers tell me the Westminster bookstore is the best place to place an order right at the moment.
Okay.
But I believe that it's coming back on Amazon within a few days. That's what I've been told anyway.
All right. That's great. Well, hopefully it will be available and readily available so people run out and go get that. So Chris, I just thank you very much for this conversation. It was enlightening. It was fascinating to be able to think through culture through a biblical lens and to think of the biblical story of creation, fall, and redemption as we reflect on culture, interact, and hopefully now we can start to be on the front lines, the front foot of what culture is saying and in these conversations, these debates, that actually the Bible has something to say to us in this modern age. And it's not a dead relic, but it's a living, breathing thing that we could actually start to interpret all of life through. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Joshua, it's been a huge pleasure for me. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to the show today. If you're really enjoying the show, please don't forget to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast app. You could do it right now. Just hit that little plus. And then I would love it if you would leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. So you could go right now to the show and leave a star rating and review and let us know how you are enjoying the show. And find us on Facebook and Instagram. So if you want to connect, interact, I post a lot of quotes and different things that you could actually interact with the episodes and let me know how you are enjoying the show. If you feel inclined to donate, there is a support the show link in the show notes, and it would send you directly to a page where you could donate so that new episodes can be produced for your enjoyment. So thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have an incredible week.